From the Sky News Centre at 5. Shock has followed confirmation we remain in recession. The surprise 0.4% fall in output over the last 3 months means the UK is experiencing its longest recession since records began. Ian Martin from the Wall Street Journal Europe believes the bad news leaves Labour's election plans in tatters.
The government had planned to spend the autumn telling us that essentially the recovery had begun and that the Tories couldn't be trusted to continue it. And that's essentially blown out the water. So the last thing which Gordon Brown wanted to happen, these figures today, has happened today.
Police want to find three men spotted at the scene of an arson attack on a family home which left a father of three dead. The fire ripped through the terrace house in Blackburn in the early hours of Wednesday. Nick Griffin plans to complain about his treatment on TV's Question Time last night. The BNP leader says he was subjected to a lynch mob and BBC bias. He's also criticised the decision to hold it in London, saying the city was no longer British. The postal worker strikes have led to 30 million letters being delayed. That's according to Royal Mail, which says the action's irresponsible. The Communication Workers Union will also carry out a three-day strike from next Thursday. Business Secretary Lord Mandelson says it's time the Conciliation Service got involved.
What I would like to see is for both sides to try again, to iron out their differences. And if they really can't manage to bridge that divide, they'll need, I think, a third-party intervention. And there's no better than ACAS to do that.
A dog breeder who abandoned nearly 100 St. Bernards to go on holiday has been jailed for 18 weeks for animal cruelty. Mary Collis left the animals unattended at Wardena Kennels in Northamptonshire. And a children's charity has thanked fans who have donated more than £25,000 in memory of Stephen Gately. The Boys' Own singer was a Goodwill ambassador for Caldwell Children. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Did you know that you can get a self-test for chlamydia? The test is free and confidential. It's as easy as peeing in a pot. If you are 15 to 24 years old, make sure you get a test every year or whenever you change sexual partner. Contact your GP, sexual health clinic, or call the Chlamydia Screening Office on 0845 180 0050.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week is the editor of the Bristol News website, bristol247.com. Our regular old Labour political pundit and economics expert, Martin Summers, is here too. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories with Chris and asking, is he able to provide a service on the web that the Bristol Evening Post can't? Also this week, we focus down on last night's Question Time, which half the country, almost, or at least half the people on watching television were watching. Were the BBC right to allow the oxygen of publicity to the BNP? Did their leader, Nick Griffin, triumph, or was he humiliated? Marina Morris has been out on the streets talking to you this week about Castle Park. We discussed the ins and outs of why the council have refused to protect the park with the town green status a couple of weeks ago. But what do you think, Castle Park? Should it be protected from all new development? For the second hour, from 6, Billy Quain is back to tell us what's on for free over the weekend. After that, in one of this programme's occasional counterpunches aimed at the banksters, we'll be hearing some amazing allegations about foreknowledge of the war on terror, 9/11 attacks and invasion of Afghanistan. You decide after 6. On to discussing this week's news in a moment, but first, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, averaging around about 13 degrees Celsius in the daytime, cloudy on Saturday, sunny spells on Sunday. Next week, with some gusty winds this weekend. Next week, though, averaging 16 degrees, up again, so some sunny spells, rain, cloudier towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 31st of October and the 1st of November, averaging 16 degrees Celsius in the daytime, dry but cloudy with some gusty winds again. And the week after next, averaging 13. That's cold again. So it seems a little bit getting colder, as you'd expect at this time of year. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Okay, so on to our look through the week's news. And with us in the studio this week to discuss it is Chris Brown from bristol247.com. Welcome, Chris.
All right.
What's your background?
I'm a newspaper journalist by background. I started out at The Independent about 10 years ago. Spent about 3.5 years there, and I'm from the West Country originally and decided to come back to get out of the London rat race. And joined the Western Daily Press 7 years ago, and I left there in April this year to set up my website earlier in the summer.
So you must be a bit multi-skilled. Are you also a web designer as well as a journalist, or have you got someone else to sort of do all the nuts and bolts of the site for you?
Well, I've had my brother-in-law teaching me over the last couple of years the nuts and bolts of it. I work with templates, and I can work with them and develop them. I'm not a programmer by heart, so I don't create something right from scratch, but I am able to work with templates that are already there, and I can produce good websites that people can use for very little money.
Does anyone take the web really seriously, though? Because surely people actually, give a bit more gravitas to the newspaper you used to work for, the Western Daily Press, when they're reading that, than they do when they're surfing around the internet.
I think that's more a cultural thing, as newspapers are the traditional media and people have lived with them for decades, and the internet is just coming into its own now, so it doesn't have that tradition, that sort of emotional kind of attachment that people will feel towards newspapers. But I think if you look at the latest sort of readership figures of the newspapers versus online publications, newspaper readership is going down, online readership is going up at a very fast rate, especially in Bristol, in comparison to the rest of the country. So I think that cultural change is shifting, and shifting very quickly.
What about what you did? What did you actually do at The Independent and the Western Daily Press?
At The Independent, well, that's my first job at The Independent. I started out sorting the post out on the news desk and answering the phone and doing all the odd jobs around the place.
And what was the newsroom like at The Independent?
So busy, yeah. Very fast-paced, a lot of high tension, a lot of stress, people running around, people on the phone all the time, shouting at each other.
That sounds like it.
Like,
yeah,
the kind of archetypal newsroom that you'd see from the films or TV programmes, but it was very, very exciting. I loved the atmosphere of being in the middle of a busy newsroom.
And so, were you a reporter, a journalist, sub-editor at the Western Daily? What were you doing when you came back to Bristol?
At the Western Daily, I turned to production, and by the time I left, I was deputy chief sub-editor. So that involved drawing up the front page each day, drawing up news pages. From time to time, I'd cover the chief sub, so that would involve working with the editor and the news desk to place stories, get them in the right place, decide how much space they were going to get in the paper, that sort of thing.
But that's pretty much an office-bound job. Did you miss getting out and getting stories?
Yeah, well, that's the bit you do miss. Yes, it was. I was always in the office, and it's now I'm doing what I'm doing. I do get out now to go and speak to really interesting people and get them to talk about their lives and all that. And it's a completely different kind of job, but it's something that it's something that I really enjoyed. But I really enjoyed the production side as well, So it's I'm getting kind of the best of both worlds now. I do a load of production, and I get out to go and speak to people as well, so I'm not totally tied to the computer.
Is there any difference between the sort of editorial philosophy at somewhere like the Western Daily and what you're doing with Bristol247.com?
The structure of how news is produced is different, obviously, because it's in real time. As soon as I've got a story ready, then I can get it published, and that's obviously a big difference.
Are you aiming it just at Bristol, or are you aiming it at a similar sort of wide area like the Western Daily, a regional thing?
No, it's just at Bristol for the time being. I'm the only full-time person on it. I've got people, sort of friends of mine and freelancers who are helping me out from time to time to help me get started and what have you, but I couldn't with that kind of resources, I couldn't go any further than Bristol. But hopefully in time, if it works here, then there's no reason why I can't set up similar kind of sites in other towns and cities.
Because I remember a couple of years ago when Stan, I forget his second name, but Stan left the Evening Post and he set up a little the Clifton newspaper.
That's right. Yes.
It was actually a printed newspaper, and it eventually folded. What makes you think that maybe you can make a success on the web where that little venture folded?
It's the economics of it. So it was great what Stan tried to produce, but producing a printed product getting it distributed is very, very costly. What I'm doing costs me next to nothing. So, you know, I'm starting to get some advertising in now, and that's profit for me, you know. So as the business builds up, as the readership builds up, which it is, then, you know, in time it should be a reasonably profitable kind of publication, which will allow me to help develop and bring in journalists on a more sort of regular basis, you know.
So I'm calling it bristol247.com. Is that wrong? Should it be Bristol 24/7?
It is 24/7, yeah, that's right.
Okay. Anyway, Martin Summers is here too, our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, by way of introduction this week, since you're so good at economics, we keep hearing about inflation and the worries about inflation. I mean, inflation will mean that any savings we have are eroded away, but are there any benefits to inflation?
Well, most of us have lived most of our lives in an inflationary environment. I was born in the late 1959, but anybody born since World War II will have lived in an inflationary environment. We are still just about in an inflationary environment, in the sense that inflation in Britain is now about 1.4%, I believe, but that's actually below the Bank of England's target of 2%. And if you think about people going about the 1970s and terrible inflation, and there was obviously inflation did get out of control at that stage, but a small amount of inflation, less than 10%, is often what you find when economies are growing and developing. And the big improvements in living standards in this country and in most other countries have usually come about during periods of moderate inflation. So the idea that inflation is 100% a bad thing is simply wrong. You need a bit of inflation, because if you haven't got a bit of inflation, your economy is not actually working at full capacity, and the danger then is you fall into deflation. That's what's happened in Japan since 1990. It's the danger we face now. And of course, falling into deflation, prices falling, sounds like a good idea, but what it means is that nobody can make a profit, and it's a vicious cycle going downwards. So inflation, in fact, is the cure for that. So inflation is not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, yes, I mean, inflation would erode people's savings, certainly, but does it also erode people's debts if they've got debts?
And it also means that people who are borrowing money find it easier to pay it back. So that encourages people to set up new businesses, like the new businesses we've been hearing about, and hope to be able to pay the debt back with less real money than has been borrowed. It's not good for those who hold capital assets. Running the economy with a degree of inflation is in fact good for entrepreneurs, it's good for workers, it's good for people who produce things, but of course it's not so good for the people with wealth who lend their money out, and they tend to be quite, you know, they tend to push for inflation to be squashed because it's actually not in their interests. But you've got to strike a balance between the interests of capital owners and the interests of the rest of society. And the capital owners are, in fact, a small minority. And, you know, when the economy's been properly managed, as it has been in previous decades, their interests have been balanced against the interests of the economy as a whole. We would be foolish now to try and get rid of inflation. In fact, all the central banks and all the governments of the developed world are desperately trying not to fall into deflation, which is potentially catastrophic.
Okay, what is deflation?
Deflation is when prices are falling instead of
prices.
Rising.
That doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't.
Really,
it hasn't happened in our lifetimes.
But is it a realistic possibility?
The last time you had serious deflation in the world economy was in the 1930s. So if you think about the situation in the 1930s, 25% of the American workforce unemployed, half the gross national product disappearing, that's deflation, and that's where you don't want to go. But I'm afraid that's where we are going, or it looks as if we may do.
I suppose the idea of deflation really is that there's lots and lots of stock of goods and products that people can't sell, so they simply have to bring the prices down to get them.
That's right.
To do something
by bringing the prices down, nobody's making a profit. So it squeezes profit margins, which then discourages further activity. People lose their jobs, they don't spend any money. I mean, a deflationary downward spiral of the whole world economy is a definite possibility, and it's an absolutely frightening prospect, which is why governments are printing money and doing various other things to try and prevent it from happening. But it's a pretty desperate situation.
OK, now let's move on to take a look at some of this week's stories. And we start with the BNP leader, Nick Griffin, being savaged by Question Time panellist Bonnie Greer. That's at least the way the Daily Mail reports last night's TV extravaganza. Can I just ask you both, did you watch the programme last night?
Yes, I did, yes.
And What the Daily Mail are saying about it is Question Time panellist Bonnie Greer today launched a savage attack on BNP leader Nick Griffin after he appeared alongside her on the BBC's flagship politics show. The black academic revealed how Mr Griffin had been trembling like a leaf throughout his appearance. She described sitting next to him as probably the weirdest and most creepy experience of my life. I spent the entire night with my back turned to him. At one point, she says, I had to restrain myself from slapping him, but it was worth it because he was totally trounced. Now, can I just get both of your opinion on whether you, first of all, whether you think it was actually a good idea for the BBC to have the BNP. Martin, maybe we'll start with you on there. Obviously, the reason why was because the BNP are actually doing very well now politically by getting seats in the European Parliament. Martin.
Well, I think it's a very difficult call for the BBC. I mean, I think this is probably just about right. The BNP do have support in this country, and therefore at some point their opinions have to be confronted. But what they've got to understand is that there's going to be a lot of hostility. You can't talk that silly. It's like calling somebody's mother a something or other, you can say that if you like, but you might get punched. And they've got to realise that their opinions are regarded by many people as abhorrent, and they're not going to get an easy ride when they express them. And that's precisely what happened. And many people demonstrated outside the television centre against him being allowed to speak. They also have a right to speak, to demonstrate against him. So, and others went into the actual discussion and confronted him in that way. I actually dealt with a BNP voter on the doorstep during the recent Euro election campaign, and what I said to them was, if you vote for civil war, don't be surprised if you get what you voted for. He was pretty nonplussed by that.
Yeah, so anyway, Chris, what are your thoughts? Do you think the BBC were right to have Nick Griffin on?
Yes, I agree, yeah. We live in a liberal democratic society, you know, no matter how abhorrent the view. The BNP, like it or not, is a legitimate political party now with, I think, 6% of the vote in the European parliamentary elections this summer. That's the best way that you can deal with views like this is to confront them head on in the public sphere. We'll probably get onto this, but I watched the programme last night, and it was all about the BNP and Mr Griffin's views. And to be honest with you, I was quite keen to hear a little bit more about what he thought about the other issues of the day throughout the week, the normal sort of format of question time, you know, just to see what kind of politician he really was. I wanted to know more about him and see what his views were on a range of different opinions. I agree. It was right for the BBC to have him on. I don't agree with people who said that because of his views on race that he should be banned. I think that's counterproductive. So by banning political parties, you're falling into the trap of the extreme right wing as well, you know. So which just adds more credence to them and is more likely to gain them to support.
Well, if I could just quote here from this article in the Daily Mail today. Speaking this morning, Diane Abbott MP accused BBC bosses of turning Mr Griffin into a victim as he was so strongly savaged by panellists and the audience. Miss Abbott, the country's best known black politician, claimed the format of the programme had been deliberately engineered to humiliate the BNP leader. It's all very well in the morning to say, oh well, he got smashed, but in the long run, people who are attracted to the BNP will come away saying he was a victim. What do you say to that, Martin?
Well, I mean, I think that's just wrong, frankly. If you're going to have them on, the people on there, then they've got to expect a robust debate. And it's going to, you know, the debate is going to be about you and your potentially Nazi views, and that's what people want to debate with you. And it's no use crying when you, if you start a fight in a playground and you get punched, well, that's what happens. And this is, we're not talking about physical fighting here, but you know, it's no use complaining that you're getting a hard ride. Lots of people find your views completely abhorrent. You're going to get a hard ride. Of course you are.
Now, you were talking earlier on about the economic situation in the 1930s. Do you think there's any link that we're having this really nasty economic situation
Absolutely.
Now, and that the BNP is kind of thriving off
Absolutely.
Of that somehow.
I mean, we've got a situation now where mass unemployment is staring us in the face, possibly for a decade, possibly for a generation. Now, in that situation, if governments and industry don't seem to be able to get their act together, obviously there's not just going to be BNP, there's going to be all kinds of violent reactions, not just in this country. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and the collapse in the economy there led communities into a maelstrom of violence against each other. That is the real danger. When some people say, oh, well, if we don't have any economic growth and we'll have to change our attitudes and we'll all have to be more self-sufficient and so on, the problem with crashes and depressions is that what happens is people start to fight. The fighting began in the mid-30s with the invasion of Ethiopia, and by 1939 it had escalated to World War level. Now, we've already got two wars running, major wars, which Britain's involved in, and lots of smaller ones all over the planet. And what can happen if the economy goes sour is that all of that just takes off like throwing petrol on a bonfire. And we've really got to be very aware of the dangers here.
It wasn't so much the anger as well towards Nick Griffin. I think it's the anger towards the situation that we face ourselves on a wider level. People are angry at the MP's expenses situation. They're angry at the economic situation as well. And you're creating a maelstrom of anger in different directions, which was all targeted at this one particular person, one particular situation last night. But I don't think you can take that out of the wider context.
One of the arguments, which I don't think that the Labour Justice Minister Jack Straw dealt with very well, was that this whole thing of immigration, as many people were saying on the programme, was that it's really the government's open border policy, virtually, I mean, which is now being reined back, which has led to so many people supporting the BNP who maybe aren't racist, but they do see immigration as a problem, and they see the BNP as the only party that's doing anything about that. Chris, do you think that's a legitimate criticism?
I think it's a legitimate perception that people have. It's a fear that people have. Certainly around in the northwest where my family are from originally, there is a genuine perception that people are, towns and communities are being overrun by immigrants. So whether that's right or wrong is debatable. I don't think it is right, but that's the fear that people have, and it adds into the anger that people feel about other issues that are around at the moment.
Well, I think this whole question of movement of labour has got to be dealt with in an absolutely fair and transparent fashion. I mean, we saw the spontaneous strikes, which were illegal under Conservative industrial relations legislation, by the way, but we saw earlier in the year. And a lot of those...
Is that the British Jobs for British People, oil strike?
All of these big construction projects. Yeah. Now, there's a simple principle, which is that nobody should be able to be coming in under rate. Yeah? If people come here to work, they've got to work at the same rate as local people so that they're not taking away their wages or their jobs. And that's perfectly legitimate. And I'll just say one thing. Most immigrants, so-called, in this country, like the East Europeans who've been working over here, are working jolly hard and paying taxes. So the idea that these people are somehow taking stuff away from you is simply wrong.
Absolutely.
It's just not the case. I mean, most of the economic migrants come here to work, and workers pay taxes, so they're actually paying for your health care, they're paying for your pension, so you've got no reason to be at all hostile to them.
But aren't they driving down wages as well?
Potentially, yes, if you don't have a robust system to protect standards in that sphere. Nobody can accept a situation where wage levels are forced down to below what's customary in the country concerned, and some of the EU regulations have been interpreted in this way, and I think that's a recipe for conflict. If you're going to bring in cheap labour to replace local workers, then of course you're going to cause anger and discontent.
Chris, did you want to come back in there?
Yeah, sure. That's what I was going to say. It's the perception of people is that people are coming in, taking white jobs and what have you, driving down wages is not right, but it's a way of how are you going to educate the wider public that of the benefits of immigration into this country, and to educate them as to what the real numbers are, and try and overcome this kind of fear factor that seems to be so easily built up and so easily played upon by the likes of the BNP.
Okay, let's move on to our next story, and this was tucked away in the Evening Post on Monday this week. Avon and Somerset police are underperforming, says the watchdog. Avon and Somerset constabularies underperforming when it comes to delivering the basic cornerstones of policing. These are the minimum standards constabularies promised to deliver, including responses to 999 and non-emergency calls quickly and effectively, treating people fairly with dignity and respect. It also says the number of police on our streets is in the bottom tier of all police forces in the country. Martin, do you want to start on this one? I mean, what does it, is it important that we're at the that the number of police on our streets in Avon and Somerset area is the bottom tier of all police forces in the country?
Well, I it's hard to comment on this because it's a kind of technical report, if you like, on their. I mean, somebody has got to be in the bottom tier. It's a bit like schools, you know. Somebody's got to be the bottom of the league table, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they're incompetent. It just means that they're at the bottom of the league table, and that's an inevitable thing. I think that.
The report said attendance times for 999 calls needs to improve, with only 70% of urban and 80% of rural targets actually being achieved. So it seems that there aren't actually the police response times are actually quite well below what they should be.
Well, in that case, they probably need to be improved. But I mean, I had an experience with the Bristol Police a few years ago, and I was attacked by a gang of young people. And they were very helpful and supportive, and I felt that they did an excellent job of looking after me in the situation I was in.
But there's a court case coming along in the next month or so, which alleges that the police, in response to a 999 call about someone who is actually an alleged knife criminal, taking 2 hours to respond to a 999 call.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then obviously things need to be improved. I mean, that's why you have these independent investigations and reports.
This is the HM Inspectorate of Constabulary, by the way. So yes, they're going around looking at all of the police around the country.
I'd just like to make one point there. I mean, one of the things that police officers have had, which is the same as other professionals, is this target-driven culture. For example, at one stage, it was under the Conservatives, I believe, that they were pushed to make more arrests. Now, I don't think that the police should have a target of making more arrests. The role of the police is to keep the peace. And in actual fact, if you can prevent crime and not have people doing crime in the first place, then you don't have to go and arrest them. And making a target of arresting people is simply a wrong target. And many police officers are frustrated by that because, in actual fact, there's many other ways of dealing with problems rather than just arresting people and creating a statistic of, we've arrested X number of people. That's a complete misunderstanding of police work, in my view.
So, Chris, should the police be biting their nails over this report? And if so, would it be the ordinary constables on the ground, or not on the ground, as the report is saying, or the chiefs up at Portishead?
Well, at the end of the day, it's a question of resources. If they don't have the numbers to get out on the streets, then they're going to come bottom in these kind of league tables. I'd like to sort of look into the data more. In more detail, because Avon and Somerset is a strange kind of force because it has a big mix of urban and large areas of rural areas as well. I mean, being from Somerset originally, as the village where I grew up in, you didn't see a policeman in the village for 10, 15 years, you know, so they were all very much tied into the local town.
Well, I think some parts of Somerset probably hardly even need policing, do they? Some of the rural parts. But I think, you know, when it comes to urban Bristol, it's quite important that when you pick up the phone and say, look, there's someone with a knife attacking somebody outside, that the police car does turn up.
No, absolutely, yeah. But, I mean, it's an interesting story covered a couple of weeks back. The local councillor near White Ladies Road, Neil Harrison, he was complaining about the number of sort of antisocial behaviour incidents that have been going on around the area, certainly on a Friday night, Saturday nights, when people are coming out of the bars, sort of low-level kind of vandalism, people running over cars and turning bins over, that sort of thing, you know. And he was getting in touch with the chief constable to try and get more, or trying to get some kind of police presence down along the strip there during a Friday and a Saturday evening. There hadn't been for a while because the police had looked into it, but they simply didn't feel they had the resources to get a couple of people, to get a couple of officers down there just to keep a watch over what was happening, you know. So, at the end of the day, it's the chief constable and his team at the top who need to take responsibility for what's going on. But if they don't have the resources in the first place, then it's going to make life difficult for them.
So through your contacts, what's morale like in Avon and Somerset Police?
I think it's reasonably good. They do what they consider to be a decent job. I think most of them try their best, you know, but they're hamstrung by what they feel is the limited number of people that they have to do the job as well as they'd like to, you know.
Right, next story, which was, I couldn't find this one in any of the British newspapers, but it's on the website Russia Today, which is one of the main English language Russian sites. The Russian billionaire suspected of mafia links. This is the Russian General Prosecutor's Office, who are requesting details from a Spanish court in a case involving Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska, famously involved in, it was his yacht which was involved in this Yachtgate scandal earlier in the year, or was it even at the end of last year, I'm not sure. The move comes after a request by the tycoon himself, who wants clarification over reports in Spain regarding his alleged links with the mob. According to Spanish newspaper El Mundo, the owner of the aluminium company Rusal is suspected of laundering 4 million euros in Spain in the early 2000s, in the early part of this decade, through bank accounts belonging to the Russian mafia. Now, do you think this is just a spurious little story, Martin, or do you think there may be something to this? I was a bit irritated because this was such a big story. The Yachtgate scandal is such a big story, but I couldn't see any of this reported in the British newspapers at all.
Well, I used to be an aid worker in Eastern Europe, and I used to work for the New Economics Foundation in the early 90s, and I saw the criminalisation of the economy in Eastern Europe largely as a result of ill-considered privatisation, which allowed well-connected people, let's put it that way, to end up controlling virtually all of the assets of countries like Russia. And Deripaska is not dissimilar from many of his colleagues in that respect. Virtually all of them were involved in some kind of essentially illegal activity. But what President Putin has done is he's basically he's got all of the information on all of these illegal deals, and of course if oligarchs like Deripaska do as they're told, then they are unlikely to be prosecuted. But if, like Korzakovsky, they start to do things that Putin doesn't like, suddenly all of this material comes out and is used against them.
So why is it coming out at this time then, do you think?
It looks like it's a pursuit by Balthazar Garzon, who is the activist Spanish judge who tried to nail Pinochet, and also he's famous in Spain for sending down the interior minister as a terrorist. He found out that he were running death squads in the Basque region, assassinating various Basque activists, and he investigated it, found out the government were doing it, and sent the interior minister to prison. Which I think is something that people really need to recognise, is that you do need an independent prosecutorial force to deal with the malfeasance of the state. But I think the real problem in Eastern Europe is that the opportunity to make money through illegal means has been opened up enormously in the past, and we're still dealing with the consequences today. And of course we had George Osborne and Peter Mandelson, so a top Tory plus top Labour politician, on a yacht with Mr. Deripaska last year. That shows how deep our politics has sunken.
Chris, what are your thoughts about this? Do you think this is something that it should be in the British newspapers or not?
I'm interested. To be honest with you, I hadn't heard about it. As always, I think it was, events kind of take over, and with the Panorama programme earlier in the week and the BNP leader coming in, so I think probably all the attention's been directed more at that. It is interesting, the links between Deripaska and obviously George Osborne and Lord Mandelson. It would be nice if someone would take it on and actually sort of see how much they really knew about his background and what his business dealings were all about.
Well, I think this may be one which will take a little while to appear in the British broadsheet newspapers. Marina Morris is joining us now. So she's been out doing some more vox pops out on the street, chatting to people. And but first of all, she's got a little report for us, Marina, haven't you?
Yes. Bristol City Council and developers still want to build on part of the green space in Castle Park. Nearly 3 years ago, developers, with the acquiescence of Bristol City Council, applied to develop the part of Castle Park known as St. Mary Le Port. The Castle Park Users Group opposes the potential development. The Castle Park Users Group submitted an application to the City Council to register all of Castle Park as a town green under the New Commons Act 2006. This was recently rejected by Bristol City Council. However, the Castle Park Users Group believes that this was illegal and is seeking a judicial review. The area of St. Mary Le Port is the area of the west end of Castle Park near Bristol Bridge and contains the little that remains of Bristol Castle. The City Council wants to disuse all buildings there redeveloped. The problem is that the developers will not do anything until the City Council agrees to sell them some more of the park. Development plans could consume up to 25% of the existing park. The area was formerly a trading area until it was destroyed by wartime bombing. In 1969, work began landscaping what is now the park. This was completed in 1978. But why are parks important to people? More than 4,000 years ago, the ancient Sumerians of Mesopotamia are believed to have created the first parks. These early parks featured hunting areas or elaborate gardens and were developed by wealthy people for their private use. The first public park were probably built in ancient Greece. By later in the 13th century, small public parks were common in many cities throughout Europe. Many parks are used for recreation and to allow visitors to relax, explore and enjoy their natural environment. They have also been called the lungs of the city. But what do the people of Bristol think about the potential change to this park, and what do they want to say to Bristol City Council?
Would you like to see additional development in Castle Park or to remain as it is?
I think it would be good to keep it as a park. Yeah. I think it's nice to have some greenery in the centre of Bristol because there's very little of it. So I think it's quite important to keep it, actually, yeah.
Developed? Yeah. Oh. I need to work. Because there's so many foreigners here that normal people can't get a job. Thank you.
No, I think it should be kept as it is because it's, you know, nice at lunchtime to come out here, have your food and stuff. And, you know, once all the building work is done on the other side of the river, it'll be nice. But at the moment, it's not so great, you know, the view, you know, with the cranes and everything else and the construction. But otherwise, you know, it's a nice little area. You know, during the summer, you get everyone sat out here, you know, eating their lunch and everything, and it's a perfect little escape in the urban oasis. You got all the shopping city, you got all the businesses and everywhere. It's a nice little sanctuary to come, I think, so it'd be a shame for it to disappear.
Definitely, I like to be this area to be developed as a park, because this is a green area and people love to, you know, sit, enjoy the evening, you know, sometime in sunny days. So definitely, it has to be a park and has to be like green like this.
So I come through here every day, and it's lovely to have a bit of greenery in the centre of the city. Keeping as a park, I think. Yeah, you need green areas in towns, so yeah. Well, for me personally, I just walk through because I live in Bath. But I see a lot of children and adults spending their lunch times and things here, so I think it's important to have a green space for them.
You're like, no, of course we have keep this park on park. Still, we like come here in the Sunday when it's sunshine.
Is it important to have green spaces in the centre of the city?
Yes, absolutely. I think for just the general atmosphere, also pollution, obviously trees are pretty important these days, and I think it's important to have a space where people can chill out in the city centre. I think it's quite good for mood and atmosphere, yeah.
Definitely, because, you know, the global environment is changing and climate is changing. For that, to protect our country, obviously, and the world, we need to be a green area everywhere. So, for the greenery?
Definitely, yes. Most of us have a lunch hour that we want to come and sit in a park. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah, definitely, because where else are people going to go out and play and, you know, meet up and things like that, so very, very important.
Have you any message for Bristol City Council?
Other than what I said, that green spaces are incredibly important, and I would definitely advocate keeping it, yeah.
I want to pass the message, please save greenery, put more trees, that's all.
Just leave it green, please, not to develop on it.
Well, it seems a pretty unequivocal message. It's unanimous, yeah. Chris, you've had a little bit. You've covered this on your site. What are your thoughts and opinions on what you've gathered about what's going on in Castle Park?
Well, it's the pressure to. It's obviously a prime piece of real estate, and it's, you know, the temptation for developers to come in and build there is obviously very big indeed. But as it's a vital part of the city to keep it as it is. You know, it's a much loved part of the city. It's where people in the city centre can go down and go and relax. And any city needs green spaces in its heart for the joy of being able to live and work there. You know, it allows people to get away from the rat race, and so any move to try and build on it, I'd totally oppose, to be honest.
Martin?
Well, I mean, I'm with the majority on this one, like most people are. I think the problem for Bristol City Council going forward, and for other councils, is going to be a fiscal problem. I used to work for the council, and one of the things that was made clear to us was the problems that the council has paying its bills to run all the things that it does. And of course, whenever, for example, a school is closed and the building is left empty, people say, well, that building should be a community building. But there's a strong financial argument on the side of the financial people in the council that if we sell the building, which is especially if it's in a prime site, and get the money from that, then we'll be able to pay for your old age people's homes and whatever other things, your parks, whatever.
Yes, but the council's actually closing old people's homes.
Well,
right
I
now.
Know, but that's the problem we're going to have going forward. You see, as we go into a depression, it's not just private companies that are going to go bust. It's quite possible that local authority is going to go bust. This is already happening in the United States, where the state of California has laid off teachers and firefighters. You'd think you can't lay off firefighters. What happens if there's a fire? But we are, you know, the problem with an economic crisis is it can actually undermine all of your plans. And then the pressure to try and maximise the income from your assets becomes overwhelming.
And with the Lib Dem administration who've come in and finally got their majority and have got a lot of big plans, came in on a ticket of coming in with and changing things as they wanted to for years beforehand, and now they're facing up to a pretty hefty budget deficit. The pressure to make as much money as they can here and there is going to be an awful lot practically,
it seems a bit strange, because we're suddenly in a recession where the shop doors are sort of being boarded up and things, and now they're saying, oh, we need new buildings. It just seems insane. What's the economics behind this?
As you said last week, I mean, what may happen, once you've changed the usage of it, the value of the land goes up. So, you know, because in the long run, people hope that if they can basically speculate on it, they hold the piece of land, the value, it holds its value, especially if it's got planning permission on it. So the decision how to zone land and whether you can develop it or not is a very, very important decision in terms of what it's worth. And the temptation for the council is to rezone it and therefore to sell it and therefore help to cover the costs of all the other goals that the administration has. I think that you can see that ordinary people don't see it like that. And what people also forget is that developers, by and large, have the whip hand. People say, well, the council shouldn't do this, the council shouldn't do that. But the fact is that developers, the law is on the side of the developer. Councils find it very difficult to block developments unless they can come up with very, very strong arguments, because we have a capitalist society with a capitalist legal structure which actually encourages speculative building and investment. And it's that, it's perhaps that should be changed.
Well, even at a time when there's so many empty office buildings.
It doesn't make any difference if you're a land speculator. I mean, the point is that there is actually derelict buildings right next to where they want to develop. They could knock those down and build there, couldn't they? But that's not the way it works. It's the way the property market works is pernicious, and it's what's led to the crash. And we need to reform our property laws so that we don't get property bubbles and we don't get property speculation. But none of the major parties are prepared to tackle this because it's just too big an issue for them, and they don't feel that people will understand when they do.
Do you think that Martin's saying is correct there, Chris? Do you think there's any scope for some of the main political parties to take this issue on about the property, you know, dealing with the property bubble and this sort of incentive just to make money out of property?
Well, I think the problem is the short-term pressure is to raise the finance, and it's an awful lot easier to raise finance from selling off some clean land that doesn't involve knocking existing buildings down than to spend a long time going through and trying to change legislation. It's the drawback of the democratic system, if you like, is you get very short-term kind of thinking that goes behind it, allied to a financial crisis as well. Long-term thinking is going to get squeezed.
Now, just before we go on to the next story, you are the editor of Bristol247.com. Now I've said it right for the first time. Could you just give us a quick take us around the site? What, you know, you do with all sorts of things, don't you? Bristol News, Bristol Sport. What can we see when we go to the site?
Yes, you get a section of Bristol News, Bristol Sport. I'm developing business coverage as much as I can as well. I've got a dedicated section called Green Bristol, which is edited by Susie Weldon, who was a former colleague of mine at the Western Daily Press, a very good writer, and she's looking after that, and that will take look at news, events, profiles, because Bristol is one of the centres of environmental businesses and environmental thinking, in my opinion. And also you've got what's on listings, you've got reviews, actually you've even got some fashion advice there as well, you know, so I've got a broad range of material there which people are helping me out with, and I do as much of it as I can myself as well.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
The next story then is Cameron's cuties. Tory anger as leader calls for all women MP shortlists. Now, it was a few years ago that Labour introduced these all women shortlists. Martin, do you want to start on this one? Because this is the first time the Conservatives have been imposing from central office all women, potentially anyway, all women shortlists onto their prospective parliamentary candidates for the next election. Is this a step forward, a step back, or what?
Well, I think in some circumstances this is a necessary step. I know that in Sweden they introduced all-women shortlists many years ago, and it actually has led to a situation where more than half of their legislature is now female. And it's just one of those things that progressive northern European countries do. I don't think it'll be very popular with the Tory grassroots. You can see that it isn't. And I suppose you could see this as almost like Cameron's Clause 4 moment, if you like, where he shows the liberal centre that he's prepared to stand up to his own grassroots. At the end of the day, of course, we should be choosing people because they're the best people, not because they're men or women. And that's got to be the ultimate decision why you should select a candidate or vote for them.
What's your thoughts, Chris? Is this a big deal or a storm in a teacup?
I think it is for the Conservative Party, yeah. I agree. And the ideal situation is that everyone, male or female, is chosen on the basis of a meritocratic kind of decision. Yes, it is a big deal for the Conservatives, and you're right that David Cameron is looking for his Clause 4 moment, because he's still trying to change the perception of the Conservatives as the nasty party and bring them into the Liberal centre ground. And
do you think this is going to do it for him?
I think he's certainly using the issue to try and show that the Tories have changed and are ready to take that centre ground that New Labour took 12 years ago. It will be interesting to see just how many of the constituencies actually do get these all-women shortlists, though. I think you might find that it may only be in single figures.
Will this issue do it for him, do you think? Do you think this is enough of a step to take him into, you know, sort of a, what some might see as more acceptable territory, you know, the idea that this is now a kind of more liberal Conservative Party?
I think it's a step. I don't think it's the step. That's probably... that's not as long an answer as I can give, but when you're trying to change the perception of the party, it's not just going to be one issue that's going to do it, but it's going to be a combination of various issues.
Okay, one of the more controversial points of view on this topic comes from a man who used to be a Hollywood film producer when he was alive, and this is all sort of to do with the equal rights for women. Aaron Russo was saying in a nutshell that women are being coaxed more and more into work because previously they were impossible to tax. Even more controversially, Aaron Russo alleges that the employment of women helps to break up the family at an early age, putting children into the hands of the state. Anyway, here is Aaron Russo talking to Alex Jones about an alleged conversation he had with Nick Rockefeller, a lawyer from the oil and the banking dynasty.
Well, one of the things they told me was that he was at the house one night, and we were talking, and he started laughing. He said, "Aaron, what do you think women's liberation was about?" And I said, I had pretty conventional thinking about it at that point. I said, I think it's about women having the right to work, getting equal pay with men, just like they won the right to vote, you know? And he started to laugh. He said, "You're an idiot." And I said, "Why am I an idiot?" He said, "Let me tell you what that was about. We, the Rockefellers, funded that. We funded Women's Lib, you know? And we're the ones who got all over the newspapers and television, the Rockefeller Foundation." He says, "And you want to know why?" He says, "There were two primary reasons. And they were, one reason was we couldn't tax half the population before Women's Lib. And the second reason was now we get the kids in school at an early age. We can indoctrinate the kids how to think. It breaks up the family. The kids start looking at the state as the family, as the school, as the officials, as their family, not as the parents teaching them." And so those are the two primary reasons for Women's Lib, which I thought up to that point was a noble thing. You know, when I saw their intentions behind it, where they were coming from when they created it, the thought of it, I saw the evil behind what I thought was a noble adventure.
Well, so that's a pretty controversial way of looking at it, Martin. You know, is it really a noble thing, all this Women's Lib?
Well, I find... The archaic term Women's Lib rather sticks in my ear. I think, of course, I mean, every step of liberation has the potential to be a step of a potential step of enslavement. I mean, who wants to work in terrible jobs under terrible conditions? Is it a liberation to be forced to both parents to go out to work in order to keep a roof over their heads? Well, it's not really a liberation, is it? But at the same time, I think that in countries like Scandinavian countries like Finland and Sweden, where they have a very interesting system, children go to nursery school from the age of three, all children, high quality nursery education from the age of three until seven, based around play, so that every child gets a really good grounding. You can pick up children who have either emotional or social problems. All children have all of this massive input and help from the state, and then at age seven they go to school. There's recently been debate in this country about whether children should not go to school, proper school, till the age of six, so that they can do more play-based learning at the early years. I think the Scandinavian model is a very interesting model, and they've had this since the 1930s, and it actually makes a huge difference to the kind of society that you end up with. Nobody's left behind. Everybody's included. The parent-teacher associations surrounding these nursery schools are socially integrative as well. So you've got the doctors' parents and the dustman's parents cooperating together to make a success of these nursery schools. And it's a hugely powerful thing for social cohesion. I don't have a problem with children going to nursery schools. I think it's good. I think what's lacking in this country is precisely that. If you want to tackle social inequality, that's what you've got to do.
Yeah, well, indeed. But you have to create a society that, if you want to liberate women, then you need to be able to provide the resources for family, for women to be able to go out to work, which, you know, which they should be allowed to do. If they haven't got the nursery resources, the educational resources for their children, then it makes it very difficult. So you have to go the whole hog and create a society where you create the conditions for liberation, for each individual, male or female, to be able to go and express themselves and live the kind of lives that they want to be able to lead. So if a woman wants to be able to go out and go to work, then yes, like I say, if she has children, then the best kind of education needs to be provided for them. If they want to stay at home and look after the kids, or if the man wants to be able to stay at home and look after the kids, then the provision should also be there for them to be able to do that as well. At the end of the day, we're getting caught up with the idea of sort of women with children here, but you have to be able to provide the resources for the children. The child is the most important part in this, really. So whether someone wants to stay at home or go out to work, it's the child's needs that needs to be met. So if they want to work, then yes, plow as much as you can into providing the best kind of nursery education you possibly can. If they want to stay at home, allow them to be able to do that and be able to resource them to be able to do that and pay their bills and pay the rent and what have you. Do it properly either way, rather than just try and have a mishmash between the two.
Now, there's another aspect to all this, of course, this story to do with the Conservative All Women shortlists, and that is that this is being imposed from the centre on all the little constituency parties. It does start to look a little bit sort of top-down rather than something that's sort of welling up from the grassroots. But, I mean, I suppose you'd expect that, Martin, wouldn't you? I suppose it's the only way to impose this on a political party.
Not necessarily.
The local parties aren't going to want...
Party, yes, because their activists tend to be to the right of their leadership, just as Labour activists tend to be the left of our leadership. I mean, that's the nature of political parties. They attract partisan people, and then the leaders have to try and carry their own people with them in a direction which they might not necessarily want to go. If you think of the Northern Irish Priest process, it's the leadership of the Republican movement which have persuaded their grassroots to pursue the political road. And I think most people in Ireland and Britain are quite happy that they did that. So there's a place for central direction, and there's a place for local initiative. And getting the balance right in a political party or a country is a matter of judgment.
Right. Looks like the final story we will be looking at, which is Tucker set to join calls for stricter control on banks from yesterday's Scotsman. The Bank of England is heading for another clash with the government as Deputy Governor. This is not the Governor of the Bank of England. His Deputy, Paul Tucker, is expected to call for tougher measures for control of exuberance in the banking sector, demanding new instruments such as tighter capital and liquidity requirements. His intervention apparently follows Gordon Brown's refusal to break up the banks, which was demanded by the Bank of England Governor Mervyn King in a speech in Edinburgh on Tuesday. Breaking up the banks, Martin, who's right on this? Is Mervyn King right to say the banks should be broken up, or Gordon Brown right to say, well, banks of different types went bust anyway, so there would be no point in breaking them up?
Well, I mean, the breaking up the banks philosophy is certainly more robust than the let's just carry on as we are philosophy, which we're getting from the government. I'm with the Bank of England on this. We need to take a much stricter line than we have been doing. But I would suggest that all mainstream discussion of this is still based on the idea that there is a private banking system, either with big banks or small banks. What people haven't taken on board is that the private banking system is in effect insolvent and bankrupt. It doesn't really exist. And what we're doing, both in the US, here and elsewhere, is we're throwing money at the existing private banks to retain the delusion that they are in fact private sector profit oriented creatures.
Listen, the banks,
they are,
Martin,
they are profit oriented, but they are not in fact private.
Can I just correct you on that? The banks do exist, Martin. I mean, you can't say they don't.
They don't exist as private enterprises anymore. Not no? effectively. Even Barclays, which hasn't taken any money from the British government, is implicitly accepting the guarantee of its deposits by the government, and of course they're owed money by the banks which have taken the money. So the whole banking system is effectively owned by the government. But none of the major political parties are stepping up to the plate and saying, well, if we own the banking system, what do we want it to be doing? They're all trying to rewind the video. Can't we just get back to private banking? I'm afraid we can't.
What's your thoughts on this then, Chris? Should we break the banks up, or just we just be nurturing them, looking after them?
I just wish we'd had some stricter controls on them about 2 or 3 years ago when things were going well. You know, it's closing the stable door after the horse has bolted. You know, it's there were people warning against the excesses of the banking industry in this country sort of throughout the last 10 years. But when everything was going fine, no one was really listening. It's only now that the system's collapsed that we're suddenly throwing our hands up and saying, "Oh, what are we going to do about them?" Yes, there has to be strict controls on the banks because they've obviously been completely incapable of regulating themselves, and because they haven't been able to do that, it's us who are picking up the pieces. And this is where we came in at the start of the programme. This is one of the things that's fueling the anger amongst people up and down the country.
What about nationalising them? Was that the right thing for Gordon Brown to do, to part nationalise these banks, do you think?
I'm no economics expert, but it sounded like the only thing, that the only option that was left open to the government, apart from letting them go to the wall themselves. And if they had gone to the wall, well, that would have been very good in terms of a free market economic kind of ideology, but it would have been extremely painful for the rest of us.
Now, Chris, will you be able to join us after the news, do you think, or have you got to get going?
I've got to rush off.
Okay. Well, it's nearly time for the Sky News at 6, but stay with us if you can, because Billy Quain will be here after the news with some world music and his weekly guide to what's on for free around and about town this weekend. Martin and I will also be back around about 6:30 for our State of the City chat. We'll be hearing more this week from that shocking interview with Aaron Russo. Is it true the war on terror is a fraud, or is that just more baloney?
Community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Are you 15 to 24? Take care of yourself and the one you love. Get a chlamydia test.